Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is Thursday, August 31st. This is host Richard Bonulli. We have returning guest Charles Hugh Smith. Charles is author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change. Also, The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy, and also Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, and Will You Be Richer or Poorer? His most recent book also is Global Crisis, National Renewal, A Revolutionary Grand Strategy for the United States. And his blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. I'm looking forward to today's topic.
Yeah, great. And this is part of our ongoing series, the Vision series, if you will, on looking at what is the best way to set up different systems, economic systems, environment systems or political systems, all different types of aspects of society. Post 2032 is the way we like to say it, because we don't see things much improving between now and then, and it could actually get worse. But looking to rebuild a new society post 2032, and so today I thought we'd do a discussion on democracy, democratic systems. Maybe we look at what's happening in different parts of the world, like in Singapore and in Switzerland. And we learn from that, does it make sense to do something similar to that? And then you had also some thoughts as well from your perspective in terms of the capture of governance by self-serving elites and how that ties into the topic.
So, why don't you lead off? I know we've already discussed it before we started recording, like this sort of the Switzerland model of localized government and how you would characterize the strengths of the Singapore governance model, which you're familiar with. You just came back from Singapore.
Yeah. So the whole issue on democracy, everybody talks about democracy, but what we have in most of the developed world is a form of representative democracy, if you will. And it's, you have some elected official that stands between you and whatever decision needs to be made. And there's a lot of problems with that. Not the least of which is some type of corporate favoritism that usually happens by the elected official, right? They're more susceptible to legalized bribery by corporations, and so in that sense, they're not necessarily representing the individual. And then just to get elected in the first place, right? It's more of a form of populism, where it's popularity type contest, to get elected. And what has happened, especially since post World War II, that's got us into the big problems we have today of excessive government debt, unsustainable government debt, is the idea that, if you elect me, I'll give you all these things for free. And we'll just print money, we'll make more debt. And, so this has been going on for decades, right? And now it's reached, it looks like saturation, because the minute you have the repurchase agreement market that's being affected, that's usually an early indicator you've reached you've reached the limit. So that happened just like a few years ago, September 2019. There was a big crisis in the repurchase agreement market, March of 2020 as well. And with interest rates naturally percolating up, so that's the indicator. And so yeah, it's all linked together. So it's basically representative democracy being rife with corporate favoritism, populism, prone to higher levels of debt, insufficient or inadequate representation, of the citizenry. And actually, importantly, the representative is generally more of a career politician, usually unqualified for the role, lack of certifications in whatever. Maybe that person has never taken a course in economics and they're serving as a minister of finance or something. So it's just crazy. What are your thoughts on that, Charles?
Yeah, I think, Richard, I think it's great to discuss like the model that has been working in Switzerland, which I'm somewhat familiar with because my brother's been living in Switzerland for many years, is that the idea that each canton in the Confederation of Helvetica, i.e. Switzerland, has quite a bit of control over policies in the canton. So if you move through Switzerland, like you actually are going to take up residence or move your business to another canton, you're going to discover like significant differences in taxation and other policies. And so and those policies are if not decided necessarily by direct all by direct democracy. In other words, there's a ballot and then the policy is accepted or rejected by the voters. It's certainly part of that process. And so the idea of, as I understand it, in the Swiss governance model, is it's like it's very similar to what we call subsidiarity, which is the philosophy of governance in which the central power of the government is limited to only those things that the central government is necessary for, which might be something like national defense, defense of the borders, and this kind of decision, but that all the all the consequential decisions about policies on the local level and everyday life are handled by the local government. So this is a powerful concept, and I think it's what we're talking about today as being like a model that has not been used or it's been overwhelmed in most places by increasingly centralized government. And one of the points of my book of Resistance, Revolution, and Liberation was to describe how centralized government, the prime directive is always get more power, enlarge your power, and expand your reach. And this is the central government's solution to every problem. I mean, no matter what you say, the central government's idea is, well, let's take more power, and we'll reach out and grab more power over more stuff, and then that will allow us to solve this problem. And of course, what you and I are discussing is actually that overreach and that power grab that's the sort of prime directive of central government is in fact the problem, because you can't really solve all the local problems with these sort of centralized policies, which, as we say, are very vulnerable to corruption, because it's a lot easier to buy the consent or compliance of 50 people in one central agency, whereas if you have the powers distributed among many cantons or states or provinces, you might have to buy 50,000 people. Well, that's just, that's a lot larger scale. So the powers that be that want to influence government and channel its power to enrich themselves, they love centralized government. The more centralized and the more power in that centralized government, the better for people trying to influence that government for their own to serve their own enrichment. So it's much more easily corruptible, and it is in fact the problem itself, not the solution. So that's kind of what we're talking about, is what's the real problem, and over centralization of power is in fact the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I see a lot of those aspects set up, how it's set up in Singapore. Of course, I mean, Singapore is a small country. It was only set up 58 years ago. And what Lee Kuan Yew, he was the designer of the country. He actually went all over the world and looked at and studied different systems, much like we're talking about. And so he came up with that system, which is essentially, as you're saying, the subsidiarity type of model. If you look at Singapore, there's different regions or areas or sections of the country, albeit small, that they're more localized, right? So they're more attuned with what's going on locally in their neighborhoods. So that's a good example of that. So it's sort of like a partial democracy, I would call it. But very importantly, it's led by educated and very certified, qualified government leaders. So, you know, the leaders, they really have, you know, studied, they're really great education, deep education, so that they can understand what the issues are, what the challenges, potentials, and offer, you know, potential solutions. I was just actually in Singapore, and I attended the Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit there in Singapore. So that was quite interesting. And there were some government leaders there talking about what they're doing and what's going on. So it was very enlightening. Very happy to see, you know, they have some real cool, nifty ideas that they're doing there for on sustainability. So yeah, that's in Singapore. You mentioned Switzerland before. You know, you have the whole voting concept there, right? Which is novel and makes sense. Again, you don't have this intermediary representative elected official there. It's more of a direct democracy type of setup, where, you know, there's a kind of an issue or a referendum that's set up, and you can just vote directly. And that, you know, today can be set up easily, right? Using cell phones, everybody can just vote. So your vote really counts, right? In that sense. And you really feel part of the system. Yeah. Your thoughts on that, Charles?
Yeah, I think that's, and I, as a recent example, within the last few years, I think one of the policy decisions that was presented to the Swiss population was whether they should institute a universal basic income or not, and it was rejected as an example of a big decision, a big national decision that was given to the public. Now, California, as a state, has a system whereby pretty much anybody with enough money then put a ballot measure on the next ballot that's a direct democracy referendum on a particular subject, like, say, auto insurance or rent control or so on. And the problem there is that those people that are going to benefit from this referendum passing, they rig or kind of engineer the proposition to confuse the voters, or to mask its eventual consequence in terms of cost, or who's empowered and who's disempowered. So my point here is that process can be manipulated, again, by money, by corrupting money that is seeking to rig the system to get a proposition passed that will benefit a particular sector, industry, group of owners, or, you know, a subgroup. And then this kind of introduces the idea that you and I discussed before we started recording, which does it make sense as common sense to have politicians and voters pass some sort of qualification test that, you have to qualify to be able to be an elected official or a voter, much like getting a license to drive a vehicle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally agree. You take a written test for and also a physical driving test, right, to get a license normally in most jurisdictions, and that serves as some level of competency to drive, right? So I think that would make sense, right, on voting to. Not necessarily everybody should vote. I think the way the US was set up is with that in mind. It doesn't, they didn't really have the intention for everybody to vote, is my understanding. The idea is you need to be a competent voter, in other words. So it has to be through some type of process. So this idea of getting a license to vote, like licensed voters, can only vote, and to get a license, perhaps there could be like a course you take on Economics 101, or and also economic political history, right? Those two types of courses would make sense because, therefore, the enlightened licensed voter would know what has happened in the past. In the history of humankind, not to commit the same mistakes, in terms of printing money or excessive, things that are leading into excessive government debt, and economics 101. So, like, if you have inflation, don't put price controls, right? Because otherwise, you'll discourage producers to produce, and the shelves will be empty, and inflation will be worse, right? This is the common human nature reaction to rising prices, so not to commit those same mistakes again, right? So I think it would make sense to have licensed voters.
Yeah, and even as you said, it's potentially something to think about for elected officials. I mean, assuming that there's still some representation, some level of representation, just to sort of at some level of governance, and that, of course, it will strike a lot of people as potentially unfair, but. When we think about, as you said, the original idea of democracy was property owners would get to vote, and people that didn't own property were not allowed to vote. And so you can say, well, that's overly restrictive. And you could say, well, yeah, that's not fair. But if you simply have to be able to read some very basic material and respond in a very simple way to show that you at least read the material. How difficult would that be for anybody that graduated from high school or even knows how to read? I mean, it's not asking too much of people to make that much effort. And I think there's an interesting psychology to this, which is having to qualify for something makes it more meaningful. And so the fact that you don't have to qualify for anything by any measure to vote, it actually demeans the value of the vote. And I think a lot of one of the cultural obstructions, I think, to the direct democracy is if people feel disempowered, like they feel like their vote's worthless, which in a lot of cases it is, then they just kind of give up. They're not interested. They don't vote, right? And so here in the US, the sort of the low rate of engagement with governance by what percentage of the population votes, it's very low because, and there's various reasons for this, but I think one is that your vote doesn't count, and so why bother? So if you have to qualify, then this gives it meaning. And I think that part of the culture that we have to create for direct democracy is to make voting meaningful, and also to to let people know that their vote does actually have power, that they are not disempowered, and they feel disempowered in a representational government because everybody knows the corporations or wealthy interest groups hold all the sway. And this has been studied, and there's been studies done that show this to be the case, right? And it's not just a theory, it's a fact. And so this also brings up the idea that we probably need, again, a cultural element. To limit corruption, you've got to have some way to control the amount of money that flows to candidates for office or anybody that can influence the propositions being given to the public. Yeah, you've got to be able to limit the potential for corruption. And of course, one idea is government funding of whatever elections do get held, and so that there's limits on how much private money can pour in to influence the population.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, to even further to your point on the corruption and the, you know, the whole concept of the representative democratic leader being influenced by corporations, right? This is a big thing that gets into the money aspects, like on taxes, where they're basically vulnerable, right, to in a legalized way, but you know, where a corporation says, okay, if you you know, give you $1 million if you can get this loophole in for the taxes and help you get reelected, right, that type thing. So you end up with this 70,000 whatever it is page code, tax code. It's just so complex, and you know, ultimately these corporations pay less, right? And then it seems less fair, right, than a more flat tax, with, you know, where it's you know, where the maybe companies have to pay a little bit more tax than they currently do, you know, because of all these codes, right, these loopholes that have been engineered into the tax code. Your thoughts on that, Charles?
Yeah, that's a great topic, Richard. Is that part of the process of direct democracy or you know, subsidiarity? Is the systems in place have to be simplified so that the average person can understand them? Like, you know, in other words, if you have to be a specialized attorney to read the 4,000-page, you know, document, no, that's already insane. You know, that's not democracy, right? That's just rigged. That's corrupt, right? I mean, it has to be like 12 pages long, 6 pages long. I mean, and there are powerful examples of very simple laws that were enacted that are a couple pages long, and that's all you need. If the goal is to enable direct democracy as opposed to enable the capture of the whole process. And so I think you're right. Like something like a flat tax with no breaks and no loopholes, it would be very simple to maintain as well. In other words, it's just, this is it, flat. And so that I think is part of what we're proposing. Is direct democracy requires it demands a simplicity of what's being proposed, and it can't be 70,000 pages long or 1,200 pages long like the absurd legislative packages that get sent to the U.S. Congress, which of course, why would it need to be 1,000 pages long? Well, I think as Nancy Pelosi famously said, we'll pass it and then you'll find out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's crazy. I think, and most importantly too, this whole concept of career politicians is not good. It causes a lot of these problems that we've mentioned. There was a time in history, the doges, the elected officials in Genoa, Italy, that they were part of like very super affluent families there, but they only got elected for and served for 1 year only. That was the system. So that was designed so that they, you know, they wouldn't enact some type of legislation or regulation that would negatively affect them the next year, right, in their business when they go back to the public, to their private sector from the public sector. So it was basically negating career politicians, right? There was no concept of, you wouldn't have a career politician at that point. So I think that would make sense also is either for any type of elected officials, if there was some element of that, to not have career politicians.
Right. And of course it's interesting how the people who are going to benefit from the government going to bat to protect their monopoly or a cartel or their interest, they can worm their way into the system. Like in California, there is a term limit, but then the politician moves from, they move from being the mayor of a town or a city, then they move to the legislature, then they move to the Senate aspect, then they go back and become some well-paid bureaucrat. So, you know, they manage to become a career politician by just moving around the governance system. And so, yeah, it's almost like you'd have to limit, like, any, you cannot serve on anything connected to governance at any level, in any agency, anything that has any remote connection to the state, right? I mean, you'd have to, like, ban anything connected to the government. Otherwise, they're just going to worm their way in to some other agency or some other legislative branch. But I also want to bring up something that, you know, we're talking about a system, and of course there's a political legal system, but there's also a cultural system. And I think when I look at least the US, and I don't know, I can't comment about Canada or other countries, but the public has to not be compliant and complicit. In other words, it just, if you're like a passive population that's given up or doesn't care, and then, or you elect, as you say, in the popularity contest, whomever is offering you more goodies for free, then you're failing your nation, right? Right? You know, like the system can't work if the populace is just complicit in like the bribery. In other words, it's like, well, the corruption's fine with us as long as we get some of it, you know. Yeah. So with that kind of complicity, and in other words, yeah, you can buy my vote, that's a kind of corruption that destroys all democracy. And so democracy requires more of its citizenry, and so the challenge is, how do you create a civically engaged populace that isn't just like offering their vote to the highest bidder?
Yes, exactly. And so, yeah, a lot of these aspects, these features that we're talking, you write about in many of your books, and maybe we can summarize those aspects to come to an end in our discussion today. But, you know, what would you say? Like, I think the concept of decentralized local democracy, I think, and government would make sense. Do you agree on that? The decentralized, localized type features?
Yeah, and I would add to that one of the things I always push is the decentralization of capital. In other words, if all the available capital and credit in the system is in the hands of the few, then of course they're just going to corrupt whatever system you have. And so there has to be a mechanism for like local banking or community banking, and funding of projects, infrastructure by the local government and local, you know, like issuing bonds that the public, like that we're talking about, the public voted for.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing, where the capital that's required to innovate and to invest has to be in the local hands somehow, some way. Because if the capital is not available and it's only held in these centralized nodes of power, then you end up with the system the United States has now, which is like there are four companies control all the beef, there's two hospital chains and so on. Basically, these corrupting cartels. And so, yeah, capital, you've got to be able to incentivize capital to be localized as well as political power.
Yeah, that's a great point. So maybe we list, so decentralized local democracy and government, subsidiarity concepts, no career politicians, direct democracy, educated, certified government leaders, simplified laws and regulations, and cultural support to foster civically engaged population, as you just recently discussed.
Yeah, I think you're right, and the possibility of actually having to qualify for voting as a means of making voting valuable.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
that sounds great.
Yeah, that's great discussion. So on our vision series here, and we were just talking also the potential topic for next time to cover on regulations, the regulatory capture challenges in the economy between government and industry, and instituting some type of regulatory review process to help foster innovation and entrepreneurialism. So we're looking forward to for that topic as the next in the series.
Yeah, that's, and it's very much is part of the same solutions, systemic solutions that we discussed today.
Great. And how can our listeners learn more about your work, Charles?
Please visit me at oftwominds.com. Archives are free samples of all my books. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Charles.
Okay, till next time.
Yeah. Take care. Bye-bye.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.